Welcome to the seventh introductory lecture on the 19 letters. And we're discussing Rav Hirsch. Last time we gave a short biography about Rav Hirsch. And now we'll discuss some of his sermons and writings. So Rav Hirsch, he had a tremendous ability to speak and to write. And he said of himself that all of my life I have engaged in thinking more than in speaking, and in speaking more than in writing. The truth is, Rav Hirsch was a master of both. If we would just look at his writings, and unfortunately we don't have recordings of the time to hear his speaking, but we could assume that since his writings have such power, and he felt his speeches had even more power, how much more so that must have been. He would give his shiurim, or his sermons, in German, always, and one time he was asked by his uncle why he doesn't give them in Hebrew, which was pretty common for Rabbanim to do. And he said that for two reasons. He said the law in East Friesland, which if I understand correctly is in the northwest part of Germany, was that a person had to speak in German. And Rav Hirsch followed this, and it's an interesting application of Dina de Malchusa. And more importantly, the population was not familiar with Lashon HaKodesh. And to properly reach the masses, you have to speak to them in their language. And Rav Hirsch, towards the end of the collective writings, I don't remember exactly which essay it is or which volume, but he writes how important it is for Abatzas Torah to present Torah to the people in their language and to have translations. Rav Hirsch used carefully chosen expressions. They say he spoke at a fast pace, that his thought was considered very original, and he had some fairly sharp arguments. He never had any open svarim in front of him, except the Tanakh, that sometimes he had a Tanakh open in front of him. He only spoke in public, meaning he would speak in shul, but he never spoke at private affairs. So a person had a simcha, so he would not speak at such an event. And when he would speak in shul, it was packed. And they say he would go on and speak for hours at a time. And this is how he united his community, and he showed them how the Torah would run their lives. They say that a visitor once commented that he doesn't understand one word that was said, but one had the impression that nothing less than the prophet Isaiah was standing up there. So that shows you, I mean, I don't know who this was, but it shows you the power that his sermons must have had. So I'd like to read two eyewitness accounts. So the first one comes from the Art Scroll biography, and this is on page 324. When he spoke Shabbos morning, generally from 9 o'clock until 10, both men and women came from all 12 synagogues in the city to hear him. This eyewitness account is from Nicholsburg. Watching him stand on the pulpit as he spoke to the congregation, one could not help being captivated by his appearance, and in particular, by his striking facial expression. One could almost see the divine spirit hovering over his head, the fire burning in his heart, and the sparks that sizzled and shot forth from his enormous eyes, revealing to everyone the intensity of feeling that lay cached in the depths of his soul. Every word aroused an insatiable desire in the listener's heart to elevate himself from the base material world and rise higher and higher to the loftiest spiritual planes. He stripped away the world's physical shell to reveal the sweet spiritual fruit concealed within. His words had the power of thunder and lightning, and against this backdrop, he stood like a sentry at his post, battling for his faith. Hearing him deride the world's vanity in tones of such animated fire, the listener could only shrink to an object non-entity in his own eyes. Behold, the mighty hero with his giant axe smashing great boulders into puny pebbles. He showed no mercy to the cruel and heartless who sought the pleasures of the material world without a thought to the needs of others. Then, just as the listener's heart could no longer bear the anguish, the tone suddenly changed and he became a soothing poet, gently feeling out a path to the delicate inner recesses of the listener's Jewish soul. His soft words were full of tender love for every Jew, especially the poor and the downtrodden, but more for the whole of creation. At such moments, a sweet light shined from his eyes, and his body swelled with the grace of his holy words. Totally free of personal vanity, he embodied the Jewish soul at the height of its glory and splendor. when he touched on history, on the history of the Jewish people, its prophets and poets, its scholars and teachers, on the ones who sacrificed their lives to sanctify Hashem's name, and on the wars and triumphs of our people, his face shone with a radiant light. Before your eyes, generations arose and flourished, and whole epochs of history passed before you. In tones of innocent reverence and awe, he evoked bold visions of the end of days, projecting in comforting terms the future, when humanity will eventually, from the depths of exile, and prophetic justice and pristine faith in Hashem, which currently lies dormant in the inner recesses of the soul, will emerge glorious to everlasting triumph. Such powerful ideals always arouse profound awe in the hearts of the audience. His addresses were given without the aid of notes or sources, and with no preparation at all. Or I guess seemingly no preparation. After each one, I would go for a walk in the forest, away from the city, and try to retain in my soul as much of the fire I had just experienced as I can keep in my memory. Okay, I'd like to read two other first-hand accounts, and this comes from Rabbinic Responses to Modernity, pages 59 to 62. So this first one comes from Sammy Jaffet, perhaps pronounced Yaffet, because the J in Germany is a Y sound. Hirsch made it a point to appear always in faultless apparel, almost stylish, according to the fashion of the period. Nothing in his manner or figure was to be strange to the crowd. This remained so during his whole life, and I could still see him as an octogenarian, immaculately dressed in the finest black suit and top hat, like a born aristocrat. A striking feature was his head, so well shaped and adorned with the most beautiful and brilliant eyes, which kept their fiery luster up to the last moments of his life. I think nobody could ever forget his countenance, animated by the magnetic glance. And whilst his outward manner was prepossessing and attractive, his character showed a strength and earnestness uncommon for any man, almost too earnest. He did not freely make friends, and even his friends he kept at a distance. Nor was he easily approached. His serenity and dignity warded off intimacy. Bold and fearless, he upheld his convictions. Only once did he yield to outside pressure when, in Oldenburg, he allowed Kol Nidre to be abolished. In later years, he made no concessions, no adjustments of views was possible, and, in question of principle, he never accepted any compromise, nor did he permit any of his communities to interfere with his opinions and beliefs. I just want to say as a side point, I mean, you see someone here who was very uncompromising in his Judaism to the world, his communities, presumably in his person. He wasn't like that. One could readily make such a conclusion. Anyway, continuing, as a scholar, he lived his own life. His intercourse with other scholars was scanty. He did not need them. Feared as an antagonist, he was born a fighter, and he hit hard. Mendelssohnian tolerance was unthinkable for him. He lived in his study amidst his books and papers, where the air was thick with smoke clouds issuing from his long, much-loved pipe. Needless to say, the religion's Gesellschaft was very proud of their rabbi. If I say the German words wrong, excuse me. His reputation as one of the greatest living scholars was a source of the deepest satisfaction. But it was in the first place his eloquence that thrilled their minds. He spoke always spontaneously without any notes. All his addresses were presented extemporaneously. He was a marvelous orator. His noble language, the rapid flow of his speech, the originality of his thoughts, the force of his arguments, together with his whole personal appearance, made his sermons irresistible and secured him a magic influence. So the next one we're going to see is much shorter. And this is from Samuel A. Hirsch, who we quoted already. We said he had no relationship to Rav Hirsch. Again, his article was written in the 1800s. That was 1890, Jewish Philosophy of Religion, and Samson Raphael Hirsch. And you could find this online. So here's his firsthand account. One word about his success as a preacher. With a preacher like Hirsch, it is as with a great singer. The effect of the performance must be felt, but cannot be described, and is lost to posterity. Whenever in his sermons some struggle, some hesitation was noticed, it was because he was applying himself the reins, not the spur. He had to restrain the great copiousness in the outpour of ideas, in the exuberant flow of words, which suggested themselves to him, and with the greatest skill he selected on the spur of the moment those that were most fitting. The effect his addresses had on his audience was always electric, that men of culture and education entered the synagogue with opinions antagonistic to his, and left it again with serious doubts as to the correctness of their views, to end in becoming his most ardent followers. But it was by his pedagogical achievements in the founding of and presiding over schools, and by his statesmanlike qualities in the organization of communities, that he exhibited himself most as a man of action, that he knew his own mind and never acted at random, but always in accordance with settled principles, is evidenced by his many articles on communal affairs. Again, I am unable to discuss them, and must therefore request my readers to inquire for themselves if they wish to know Hirsch in quite another character. That his theories were sound, and that his activity proceeded in the right direction, cannot be shown better than by pointing to the congregation which he created in Frankfurt on the Main. Okay, so again, we discussed how, and we mentioned that opponents would come in to hear him and sometimes would leave as followers. And Rav Hirsch felt that the ability to be a strong orator was so necessary and so important that when he attended Bonn University, for that one year, he began a public speaking organization to train rabbis how to speak properly. And just as a side point, the Chassam Sofer, in his yeshiva, he also required public speaking as one of the courses. Okay, so let's try to examine Rav Hirsch's writings in some way, which are voluminous. There are tons of them. His writings, we could say, had a greater influence than his speeches because his writings last throughout time. Depending where you are, they're fairly popular today, especially the Chumash with the new translation has really seen a resurgence. And we could probably also say that no one since has really equaled his ability to portray Judaism with such conviction and such inspiration that he was able to really capture the sanctity and the beauty of Jewish life and the closeness to Hashem. I mean, just thinking, since the time of Rav Hirsch, other people that might come close to such a thing comes to mind, like Rav Kook, maybe, or Rav Soloveitchik, but still, it's very, very different than Rav Hirsch's presentation. He wrote in very polished German prose with very long sentences, and the sophistication of his writings took people by surprise because Orthodox Rabbanim were not known to be sophisticated in the vernacular. That wasn't really their type of thing. And Rav Hirsch wrote, as we discussed this before, his Sfarim, or at least in Chorav, it's written in the cover letter, that his Sfarim were for the mainly thinking young men and women of Israel. And we pointed out how the fact that he dedicated his Sfarim to women as well was considered a real innovation of the time. Just to discuss briefly culture. As far as culture is subsumed under Torah, which we discussed a little bit and we'll discuss more, so Rav Hirsch was into secular studies, humanism, aesthetics, because all knowledge has its source in Hashem, so it must perforce fall under Torah if it's true. So again, this all comes with the caveat that it's from Torah itself, that it falls under Torah. Now, besides for Kant, we mentioned Hegel briefly, that Hegel's ideas were around at the time, and Rav Hirsch was definitely aware of them, and Schiller. So here, Kant and Hegel, Rav Hirsch maybe doesn't quote them too often, but Schiller, Rav Hirsch we know was a tremendous fan of, and he once said that the universal principles of Western culture embodied in Schiller's writings were really Jewish values that originated in the Torah. And that's how Rav Hirsch generally saw secular culture, that these were ideas that were rooted in the Torah. And Rav Hirsch was such a fan of Schiller that he wrote a famous eulogy on Schiller. So two different translations could be found of it. One could be found in the Torah Mada Journal. This is volume 15, 2008-2009. And this is on page 172 by Mark Shapiro. And the other one can be found in volume 9, the newest volume of the Collective Writings. Literature that Rav Hirsch found offensive to Torah, so he was, to say the least, critical of. And the story goes that he was once reading Hein, and he was so incensed by its blasphemous expressions that he said he would burn the book and he would pay the library for it. And I don't think he did. He said he wanted to burn the book and pay the library for it. But that shows you how he didn't have much patience for blasphemy when it was related to Torah. Okay, so let's have a look at Rav Hirsch's understanding of emancipation and what did he think of it. Again, most Rabbanim at the time thought emancipation was terrible. As we just said, in Eastern Europe, the main response was to basically close up shop and not have anything to do with it. So the negative sides of emancipation are obvious. You get religious indifference. The Kehillah basically fell apart. There was definitely an increase of anti-Semitism in a very different way. And sometimes you might see reaction of that coming out of, let's say, like the ACLU, Chaim Aben Yavin. Now, in general, Rav Hirsch felt that emancipation was good. It was a challenge, and it was an opportunity to show how Torah is applicable in open society as much as it was in the ghetto. And this is really the root, one of the roots of Torah Darach Eretz. Rav Hirsch held that we were forced into the ghetto. That was something that was forced upon us. But the applicability of Torah in open life, that's in open society, that's really where Torah is supposed to take place. And it allows for a fuller Jewish life. The ghetto, it really robbed Jewish learning of its intended vitality, since many situations could not be applied to life. And the goal of, Rav Hirsch wrote that the goal of study has not been practical life, to understand the world and our obligations in it. And he held that emancipation was a step towards our goal, that every Jew and Jewess, through the example they provide in their own lives, should be the priest of God and genuine humanity. And Rav Hirsch, he held how Torah's Chaim is exactly that. It's alive. It's not confined to the Beis Medrash, but it's applicable in every contemporary issue. We'll actually see later on, actually much later on, when we discuss Torah Lishma and the different views of it, that this comes out very much in Rav Hirsch, how he always showed how Torah was done for action. And Rav Hirsch held that the non-Jews are becoming better and more enlightened. The freedom of the Jewish people is a better way to be the Or LaGoyim that we're supposed to be. Now, it's very hard for us to look back on the statements that Rav Hirsch writes about the non-Jews becoming better and better in light of the Holocaust. Yet at the same time, his writings are filled with warnings about society. And you could see that he was aware that such a thing could happen. And I would just say that when you have people such as Schiller, whose writings Rav Hirsch held very much were in line with Torah, and you had a lot of non-Jews at the time who felt that the Jews were welcome in society and that we had what to contribute to society and all the advantages that it has for us, the fact that that went sour within 60 years after Rav Hirsch or whatever it was, does not necessarily show that Schiller was not following Torah ideals. It shows you that the anti-Semitism of the time, which was also existed in Rav Hirsch's time, was something that came to the fore for whatever various reasons you want to attribute it to. Hashem, really, at the bottom line, because there's really no other way to say it. And I would say, we could say again today, that among many non-Jews, that we're in this very similar type of situation, that they're becoming better and better. Again, you certainly don't have that across the board, but you have a good chunk of people, especially in the United States, where you could certainly see such a trend. And I hope that we could discuss that more later on. And just to end off here, it's interesting to note that six generations about after Rav Hirsch, that just about all his descendants are observant Jews. And that really attests to his influence and his outlook on Torah and on life, in that he was successful also in his own family, which is not always the easiest thing, especially for a Rav. A lot of times you find that the effect that the Rav's children go off the derech over here, they all grew to be from Jews throughout time. Anyway, so this ends the basic background material, and next time we'll do an introduction to the 19 letters.